everyone, and welcome to Minute 137 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Stephen J. Rubin, author, screenwriter, producer, documentarian, and overall Great Escape expert. Welcome back to the show, Stephen. Steve.
Thanks. That's fine. You can call me Mud. Whatever you like, Rob. We're kin folk now that we have shared our love for this classic movie.
I'll just call you Hiltz.
That would be an honor. By the way, when I saw the Tarantino movie and Leo DiCaprio comes on as Hiltz, I almost fell off my chair, and I thought that whole sequence. I learned that Quentin Tarantino is a huge fan of The Great Escape.
So I've heard.
I think it's top 10 of all time.
Yeah. Well, if you know how to get in touch with him, I'd love to talk to him about this also.
if you have connections. I met him once in line. It was in 2001. I was going to see The Thin Red Line, and I'm looking down the line, and there's Quentin Tarantino standing by himself in line to see Terry Malick movie.
Right. Oh, wow. I mean, I do live a little closer to him than you do, since he lives in Tel Aviv. But
Quentin Tarantino lives in Tel Aviv?
Yes. He's married. Oh, he's married to Svika Pick's daughter, Donna Pick. And I know that they were here during you know, the whole COVID thing. He actually, I recall seeing him, he did an interview on one of the talk shows where he basically said that you know, he doesn't like living in foreign countries, but you know, if you're gonna pick a foreign country to be in, you might as well be the one that's the first to beat COVID. So,
oh, interesting. Okay.
And what did you think about Leo's performance there? Do you think that if they were to make a remake of it, he would be the perfect actor to cast in that role, or do you believe, like I do, that you could never remake this movie because it's near perfect as it is?
It is near perfect, as there's no way anybody could ever play McQueen. Even Leo, who I love, by the way, I love everything he does. Even he looked a little bit like he was, like, you know, kind of mimicking Steve McQueen. And it just, it was okay. Steve McQueen's kind of cockiness is very hard to duplicate. And we could talk for...
Especially in this movie.
Oh, yeah. We could talk for hours about his nuances. And, you know, I know you've talked about it, but the whole idea that Sturgis at one point fired him and was going to replace him with Garner, that Garner was going to take over the whole McQueen role, it sounds completely preposterous to me that this could happen. But indeed, and Relyea confirmed that Steve sat out for 6 weeks. And I just can't believe that everybody went to work every day and he sat in his hotel, in his cottage cabin, whatever you call it, and drove around the countryside in his Mercedes and probably got pulled over by the cops at least 8 times a week.
Yeah, I love that quote, Mr. McQueen, you get the prize. You've driven the fastest of anyone that we've caught today.
You couldn't slow Steve McQueen down anywhere else.
Well, that we know. I mean, that's one of the reasons why he did Le Mans in the end. You know, he wanted to be able to race it himself, which the rumors are that he actually does a lot of the racing.
It is interesting that he and Garner both became big racing fans, and both of them did major movies about Grand Prix racing. You know, Garner did Grand Prix, and then McQueen did Le Mans. And then, of course, Paul Newman was also another guy who McQueen was very competitive with, and he was also doing racing stuff. So yeah, it was interesting. Race cars. It was interesting. At one point, I think I heard that had McQueen been truly fired, he was being touted to race for the British racing team. There's a possibility he could have joined Stirling Moss and that whole group and become a professional automobile racer and not missed a beat. I think he loved the adulation of acting, but I think he probably was more passionate about car racing.
Is that because he liked to live on the edge, you think? Or was it because, you know, was it just a thrill that, you know, he couldn't
it is a good question.
Anywhere else?
I mean, I wish you and I could sit him down and have a conversation with him and talk about what his passion was. I think he would say that he loves racing, whether it was motorcycles or automobiles. I think the thrill of action was very important for him. I think he always regretted the fact that he couldn't have done more of the driving in Bullitt, that, you know, buddies did a lot of the driving for insurance purposes. But McQueen lived on the edge because he didn't have much upbringing. You know, he lived, had a very troubled younger life. So I don't think he slowed down much, you know.
No, not at all. Not at all. But, I mean, I know that you've interviewed his son. You interviewed Chad McQueen.
Chad says that he was just enjoyed riding fast motorcycles. And unfortunately, later in life, as he got into his 40s, my image of Steve McQueen is sitting in his hot tub in Malibu smoking dope. I mean, he wasn't moving much. And then he went through that whole period where he grew that big bushy beard. He was almost unrecognizable. And he did that movie Enemy of the People based. It's just.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Just a depressing, god-awful movie that nobody really wanted to see. Thank God he came back and he did, you know, Towering Inferno, which is like one of my personal favorites of his. And of course, he did the Hunter movie, which I think was his last movie. You know, it's interesting today, yeah. Rob, that they don't make actors like Steve McQueen anymore, not even close. I mean, I would say the closest we have to the swagger, maybe, and we saw a little bit of it in the Tarantino movie, was Brad Pitt. I think Brad Pitt has some McQueen qualities to him. Mm-hmm. But McQueen is basically his own man. And it's interesting, and this is a side discussion, but basically a lot of the actors today are not Americans. The major actors in the world are Brits, Australians, Irish, you know, Welsh. The training for acting over in in England is a little bit different than it is here. I have a tendency to think that we produce a lot of pretty boys, and they don't have the grit. And Steve McQueen definitely had the grit because of his upbringing. He wasn't a polished guy at all, but he grew into one of our most magnificent movie stars.
Yeah, no question about that. And the iconic picture of this movie.
Of course.
Completely. All right, well, minute 137 begins with Cedric continuing his ride through the countryside and goes all the way till we get to see Cedric looking at a train getting ready to depart. So basically this entire minute that we're going to be discussing is it's got Cedric and we get a few of the other escapees along the way.
So see, Danny and Willie rowing their boat down the river. That mm-hmm. little town that they're about to cross under the bridge, that's Fussen. That's the town.
That's interesting because the bridge looks like the bridge right next to the cafe. So exactly. I assume – actually, it is. It is. I can see the white pole that's right outside. If you look at the frame, so on the right-hand side of the bridge, there's that white pillar.
Yeah.
Which appears right outside of the cafe. Wow. That's very interesting. I never noticed that. Thank you for pointing that out.
Oh yeah, that is definitely Fussen. And Coburn, of course, is the Sturgis told me some interesting things about Cedric. As Coburn says, he just is so nonchalant and relaxed as the escapee. He's the opposite of everybody else that is running and being chased, etc. There's a moment in the movie which you've already seen where he's entering the escape tunnel, and I think Soren says to him, "What do you have in there? A piano?" And says, "No, that's very funny, man. You're never going to get this through." Well, in that, we never see what's in the suitcase.
I've actually heard it. It was a scene that was filmed and cut.
It was cut. It's basic. Sturgis told me that inside the suitcase is a pup tent. And all these camping gear things, you know, Sedgwick, the manufacturer, has basically created a little survival kit for him, although we never see him pitch a pup tent, although that would have been funny. He's got it a little bit easy. I think in the book, if I'm not mistaken, his character is kind of patterned on Johnny Dodge, as I recall. Johnny Dodge was one of the guys who did escape. And was a bit flamboyant and kind of a bit of a swashbuckler, which is kind of Sedgwick. And Coburn is so fun to meet him and hang out and talk to him back in 93 when we did the Great Escape documentary for Showtime. He was just so proud of the film and so complimentary about Sturgis.
Well, he's worked with him before and after. You know, he liked working with him. I think you might have misquoted one thing along the way. Sorry to point this out, but I think Dodge was. I'm sorry.
I'm an older guy now, so I'm certainly capable of being misquoted, or actually,
no,
of misquoting.
Right. No, what I wanted to say was is that with Sedgwick, if he was based on Dodge, who was known as Artful Dodger,
right?
He was actually a cousin to Churchill, and he was let out. He actually didn't. He was caught, and then he was sent to a different prison along with three other prisoners, and then they let him go out of goodwill in order to try to appease Churchill at the time. So Sedgwick isn't based on him. Sedgwick is actually based on someone named Johnny Travis.
Okay, so it was a John. I had Dodge.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that everyone was a composite of various characters, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, interesting. Absolutely. I mean, when you read the book, you see some of the characters really stand out.
By the way, Coburn,
as being part of these.
Coburn, you know, we talk about Steve McQueen being the king of cool. Coburn had a coolness factor of his own. I mean, obviously, yeah, we most of us first saw him in Great Escape in The Magnificent Seven as Britt the Knife Fighter, who's ice water in his veins, and there's a certain coolness about Britt. I think Sedgwick is a little more of a flamboyant character, but the way he escapes and his coolness under, you know, as everybody's running everywhere and he's doing the escape kind of coolly, stealing the bicycle. I love that.
He's also one of the few who actually escapes on his own. Most of them are escaping in pairs. I mean, you have Henley and Blythe, you have Roger and Mac, you have Haynes and Nemo.
Nemo
that escaped together. You actually mentioned something about that they filmed. You told me before we were recording that Haynes, his escape was actually filmed. There was a point where he got where they filmed that, but it didn't make the final cut.
Sturgis told me there's a sequence where they're tracking down Haynes, and he races into a gully and gets into a storm drain. And he's hiding out in this storm drain, and then they're coming after him. There's a little bit of action showing him. As you and I have discussed, the most dangerous thing I could possibly think of for an escaped prisoner is to dress up in a German uniform. It's almost like
completely.
You have a signboard on your back of your uniform saying, shoot me now, because I'm wearing I won't use the word, but your blop.
You can say it. I'll just bleep it out. It's fine.
No, I'll just say your bleep bleep uniform. So that was a little bit dangerous, but it certainly was colorful, and it certainly set Haynes apart. And Haynes, of course, has that great moment where McDonald's trips him up, telling him his accent's very good. Thanks, man, and whatever. But yeah, so they did film that. They filmed a few sequences. There's a sequence where McQueen is underneath a German truck siphoning gasoline for his motorcycle, and he's eating...
Right, that was in the script. I read that in the script.
Yeah.
I didn't know they filmed it.
They filmed it, and he's eating one of the rations. Apparently, they put a lot of effort into creating these little escape rations, which were these little kind of nutritional bars, which apparently tasted like sawdust. So I guess when McQueen finishes siphoning off the gasoline... he takes his little piece of ration and stuffs it into the truck. So that was one thing I remember telling me about. And I'm trying to think of some other sequences Sturgis mentioned this year, but Haynes being chased and McQueen. I mentioned earlier, of course, Sedgwick and his little pup tent and creating his little campsite.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, now in your documentary, the coolest guy movie ever. So that was narrated by Lawrence
Montaigne,
who played Haynes. Haynes. Now, did he ever have any? Did you? I'm assuming you had conversations with him about
it.
Yeah, also,
I think he confirmed that there was a more footage shot of him. You know, he's the Canadian in the group. Haynes, the Canadian. We were delighted to get to him. We interviewed him in Las Vegas. We did the narration track. and really a terrific mm-hmm. guy, known probably more for Star Trek than for The Great Escape. You know, he.
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Of course, of course.
All right. And did he? Do you remember anything he might have said to you about, you know, the filming? Because he actually passed away before your documentary was released.
Right, he died shortly after we interviewed him. He was in Las Vegas. I don't remember him saying anything really that stands out. I think he did say that wherever he went mm-hmm. and they saw The Great Escape on his resume, he got first-class treatment.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty amazing. And when you talked with Coburn, did he ever mention anything about the fact about his fake Australian accent? Because that's one of the things that a lot of people make a lot of fun of this movie about, that you know, his accent is completely not Australian.
Right. No, we didn't talk. I think during the interview, one of the things we don't want to do is piss him off. So I think, but he's, as you see from the interview footage, he's sitting there smoking a cigar in his living room in Beverly Hills. He was in command and had some interesting things to say about the film. And as I said, just big fan of Sturgis. Obviously, Sturgis got him into The Magnificent Seven, got him into The Great Escape. Certainly high points of his career.
So then we get to continue seeing Danny and Willie rowing through the Fusen, as you pointed out. And then it cuts away and we get to see Hiltz riding on his motorcycle.
And by the way, we're watching this, we're also getting into Elmer Bernstein's score. And I have to say that, you know, Bernstein's score is obviously a classic, at least as far as I'm concerned.
I think as far as anyone's concerned.
Exactly. And his music for Hiltz just soars. And particularly in this run where he's about to realize that Switzerland is up ahead, and I love this sequence. I can't tell you how many times sitting on my little Schwinn bicycle, I would shake the middle of the frame and say to myself, Switzerland.
and you check on your bike if you have enough gas.
Absolutely. I think that it's interesting. I don't think there's ever been a role that shot an actor faster into international stardom than Steve McQueen on the motorcycle. If you had to pick an iconic moment in 1960s cinema, perhaps in all cinema, it would have to be this. Because after this movie, he was probably the most sought-after actor in the world.
No question about that. I mean, and again, he added this whole sequence with the motorcycle throughout, you know, into the movie. Because it's, as we all know, it happened in during The Real Escape. But, you know, for as much as they tried keeping it out of the movie in the first place, nobody wanted it in the movie. And then, you know, he was able to convince them that either you put this in or I'm not doing the movie. So, you know, they agreed to finally put it on.
Well, I don't believe for a second that they didn't want it in the movie. I believe that first of all, Sturgis knew what he had in McQueen. He knew what McQueen was capable of. Not dialogue, by the way. McQueen, Sturgis in The Magnificent Seven gave McQueen only a few lines. And he realized that McQueen was such a presence on camera that he could give you so much with just a wink. He didn't have to say anything. And in fact, after The Magnificent Seven, I think Steve McQueen started to pay more of attention to the fact that if he didn't like the lines, he would just cut them away. And all of his subsequent performances, it is not dialogue driven stuff. He doesn't talk that much. He's just such a strong presence. And this sequence, particularly coming up here where he gets into the checkpoint, is one of my favorites in the whole movie.
Right. Now, you might know this better than I do. I don't know anything about motorcycles, but if you move the bike back and forth to check the gas, does that help? You know, it's like it's going to be pushing something, you know, into parts of a motorcycle, but it's not. The idea is to see, is it swishing around? Is there still any gas in there? But that's not really helping him get a little further.
I think it's complete balderdash. I think that it was a good little thing to do. Obviously, he's looking for the swishing of the gasoline, but I don't know. I don't ride motorcycles. I find motorcycles scary as hell. That's why I have such respect for McQueen being able to ride this motorcycle, which, by the way, I don't know if you talked about it. It's a Triumph, but they disguised it with BMW features to give it a more of a German feel.
Well, but it was also a cycle from 61 or 62.
Yeah. Well, obviously not a vintage motorcycle. Yeah,
just like his baseball glove. You know, those are more modern things for 1962.
Right, right. I actually didn't realize that was not a vintage glove.
No. I think it was a glove from the 50s, from what I understand.
Interesting. Yeah. So McQueen's on the motorcycle. He's swishing the gasoline. He's saying Switzerland, and just he's a little freaked out. Then he goes into this checkpoint.
We don't get him at the checkpoint yet. We're not there yet.
We're gonna cut
right. But what I found interesting is we discussed this earlier about the fact that Haynes, you know, was dressed in German uniform, which will get you shot. So, you know, Hiltz did the exact same thing. He could easily get shot. And what's interesting is that you, at least when you see him here, you can't see if he has a gun. I know that later on we know that he does have a gun. Actually,
I think he stole a piece from the...
Yeah, oh, no, he doesn't. Okay, you can see the holster. It's hidden by his arm
right
through most of the sequence. But, yeah, he has that there. And then we continue along, and we get to see a train track. And then we get to see Sedgwick strolling along nicely on his bicycle across the train tracks.
Which is a nice around. Contrast to McQueen is dashing all over the place, you know, being chased. And, you know, Sedgwick's out for a stroll. You know, nice little counterpoint.
Exactly. Completely. He looks over at the train, and that's where this minute actually stops. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention, and you probably know, in the original script, so the Sedgwick character is more connected, more like the character of Cavendish during the escape, where the way he gets caught, because he's not one of the, in the original script, he's not one of the three that makes it out safely. There's another character named Mary Vale, who I think, the fact that you just mentioned right now, the contrast between Sedgwick and Hiltz, where Sedgwick is strolling along calmly and Hiltz is riding along at super speed. So I think the character Merivale was somewhere in the middle, because when in the script, at the point when they are German, when the Gestapo are checking in, he goes into the bathroom or the washroom and climbs out the window onto the top of the train and then hides on the top of the train as he's going, and then ends up jumping off the train at some point along the way. Do you have did any discussions that you might have had with Sturgis or anyone else, did they ever mention this character? Because he's mentioned throughout the entire script, and for some reason he just disappeared.
It's a very good question. I think it'd have to stay a mystery, Rob, because I have not heard anything about Mary Vale. As I mentioned to you before our talk, I think that Sturgis admitted that they didn't have a finished script when they were shooting the movie. A lot of it was being written as they go. And as far as I know, McQueen's whole sequence where he goes out of the camp to get the maps was written after the fact, because he wanted more to do than just sit there bouncing the ball against the cooler wall. I think that's part of the reason McQueen walked off the set and stayed away for 6 weeks. He thought his character was really underdeveloped. He didn't like the fact that James Garner had that turtleneck sweater. Really pissed him off that he had this torn sweatshirt under his bomber jacket, and he felt really underwhelmed by the role. By 62, Steve McQueen had a real sense of what he could do with the character, and I think at that point, and this is before any of the stuff with the motorcycle, the thought of spending the first 2 hours of the movie just bouncing a ball pretty much really pissed him off.
Yeah. But the irony of it is, when you think about it, you know, 59 years later, those are some of the most iconic points of this movie. Anyone, if you ask them, can you recall a movie where a character is bouncing a ball against the wall? Most people are going to say, oh, that was the Great Escape. That was Steve McQueen in The Greatest Escape. And if you say, okay, and what about someone on a bicycle riding through German countryside and jumping over a fence? You're going to get the same answer. So, I mean, what I recall hearing, I think this was, I either read it somewhere or I saw it or I listened to it on the commentary. Basically, Sturgis kept telling, the way he convinced McQueen not to quit was he basically said to him, just wait. This is, your character is the focal point of this. And when he finally saw the finished cut, he realized that he was right. You know, he is the backbone of the movie because he's the character who constantly has hope. And he's the one who gives everyone else hope.
Well, Garner has an interesting quote, which I use in the documentary, that McQueen told Garner says that McQueen wanted to be the hero, but he didn't want to do anything heroic. It was almost like just kind of an interesting oxymoron. I think that my sense is that Steve knew this was based on a true story, and he didn't want to take away from the actual events. But I think that, as Garner says, Garner and Coburn both cornered him one day and basically got him to come back to production. That's what I heard. But it was a combination of things. Steve McQueen's agent came out from L.A. to talk to the production. They brought out another writer to type in a scene where McQueen does agree to go out for the maps, which I don't know if was in the original script. Did you notice whether it was in the original script?
It was in the original script, but it was very different. It was, I think it took place right after there was apparently like a fire that they had to take that they had to put out or something like that. It was something that happened on the fly in the middle of in the original script. It didn't happen the way it does in the movie, where you have Roger and Mac in the barracks with him trying to convince him. It was done very differently.
Right. That was written, as I believe Ivan Moffat came out from Hollywood and became the fourth or fifth writer on the show to help thread McQueen into. Because if you think about it, most of McQueen is indeed bouncing the ball. The only time he seems to get out is when he's having that conversation with Bartlett and Mac about getting the maps.
No, you also see him carrying the piles of slats.
Which is one of the most preposterous moments in the movie, because I'd like to know, where is he going to take that wood?
What do you mean? They use that wood in order to shore up?
No. But I don't think he's in the right hut, and he has to go outside with that pile of wood. Or how? I'm just curious where it's going, because it didn't sound like it was in the right hut to do that. But then again, I'm not going to nitpick, because if you start to nitpick, you denigrate the movie.
No, but that's what we're doing here. We're nitpicking. we're finding continuity errors as much as possible.
Oh yeah, well there's a few there. I agree with you.
That makes part of this so much fun, that you get to you know, you can still love the movie, but you can love it even more by knowing all the small little details that are happening along the way.
Exactly.
All right. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Oh, the best way is through my Facebook pages. I have Steve Rubin, Saturday Night at the Movies. I've got the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia, and then I just have plain old Steve Rubin, R-U-B-I-N. Anybody who writes me a note on Facebook, I'm
proof of that.
There you go.
All right, and you can contact us by going to our website, thegreatescapeminute.com. Our email address is thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler, and our Twitter account is Great Escape MXM. Steve, you want to do another one of these? You want to come back in tomorrow?
I am so there.
All right. I will see you there. So until tomorrow, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.